A grand jury in Georgia filed criminal charges against former President Donald Trump and others in Georgia earlier this week. Here's Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis making that announcement.
A Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment, charging 19 individuals with violations of Georgia law arising from a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in this state.
This is the fourth criminal indictment brought against the former president this year. We're taking a look now at this latest round of indictments, how they fit into the broader legal landscape of charges brought against the former president, and updates from on the ground in Georgia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about the most recent indictment of the former president? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll start in Georgia with Sam Greenglass, a reporter for WABE News in Atlanta, where he's been covering the Fulton County probe of the 2020 election. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been watching this Fulton County probe evolve over the last, what, 2.5 years. Can you remind us how it got started there in Georgia?
So this investigation really began not long after this infamous phone call in the weeks after the 2020 election. This was between Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and then President Trump. Trump asked the Secretary of State to find him votes, the number of votes he would have needed to win Georgia, even though Joe Biden had already been declared the winner. A new district attorney in Fulton County had just taken office around that same time. And it wasn't long before she began this investigation in earnest to figure out if crimes had been committed in these efforts to subvert the election result in Georgia.
I know the prospect of indicting former President Trump, it's been contentious around the country. What has the chatter been in Georgia leading up to and now after these indictments were released?
Well, I think in the beginning, people were still really needing to digest. These indictments came late in the evening on Monday. So many people woke up to the news. I would say many Democrats see these charges as the first steps toward accountability for people who they see as having tried to chip away at their voting rights. And then within the Republican Party, it is more of a mixed bag. You have figures like Georgia's Secretary of State Raffensperger, who I just mentioned, who had a statement saying that the most basic principles of a strong democracy are accountability and respect for the Constitution. But then you have, the state party, Republican Party apparatus, who is calling this investigation partisan, channeling much the same language that we have heard from former President Trump and calling it a partisan witch hunt.
What happens next, Sam? You've got former President Trump, 18 other people charged here, and they what have to show up, I think, at a local jail to report in?
So the district attorney has told the defendants that they have until next Friday at noon to voluntarily surrender. They will be booked at the Fulton County Jail. And we've just learned this afternoon that the district attorney is requesting arraignments to begin the week of September 5th, heading toward a proposed trial date on March 5th of next year. So all of this is moving rather quickly after this long investigation, though I expect there to be many factors that slow this process down as we really get into it over the next couple of weeks and months.
And before I let you go, Sam, the district attorney, Fani Willis, had hinted that, you know, there might be some sort of turmoil, protests, whatever might happen. Has there been any sign of that, at least so far, since this announcement late Monday?
You're right. The district attorney told law enforcement to prepare for a significant public response. She has talked about many of the threats that she's received, many of them racist. The law enforcement have said they've investigated many of them. But in the end, it was fairly quiet outside the courthouse this week, apart from the many TV trucks and throngs of reporters and police officers who were lined up. No real protests in downtown Atlanta as this decision has unfurled. But of course, there'll be plenty more opportunity. We have arraignments and booking and many more steps ahead in what's going to be a very long process.
Sam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Sam Greenglass, reporter for WABE News in Atlanta, where he's been covering the Fulton County probe of the 2020 election. How do these charges fit into the growing list of indictments against former President Trump? Cheryl Bader is a clinical associate professor of law at Fordham University Law School and a former assistant U.S. attorney in the District of New Jersey. Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be with you.
Now, this is the second set of indictments related to former President Trump's action in attempting to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election. How do you see what we saw in this indictment comparing to the federal indictment on these issues?
So there are a lot of similarities. They cover a lot of the same ground. But Smith took a very narrow focus. I think strategically he wanted to streamline the case. He only charged Donald Trump, even though there were other, you know, unnamed co-conspirators there. So that's a, you know, one big difference. Another difference is that, you know, he went in a more cautious approach as to what he charged. For instance, he didn't even charge inciting an insurrection, which is something that many people were expecting. Whereas the indictment here, Willis has actually done a very expansive indictment, as was mentioned, 19 people, and also charged pretty aggressively, including the state's RICO statute, which gives her many advantages in terms of evidence that she can bring in.
I want to give a listen to District Attorney Fani Willis in Georgia talking about that, the racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization, or RICO. Here's a listen.
Every individual charged in the indictment is charged with one count of violating Georgia's Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act through participation in a criminal enterprise in Fulton County, Georgia, and elsewhere to accomplish the illegal goal of allowing Donald J. Trump to seize the presidential term of office beginning on January 20th, 21.
Let's talk about that RICO concept, Cheryl. Different states have different statutes. Georgia's is a little more expansive, I understand it. But in general, what does it mean when prosecutors and grand juries are pursuing indictments under RICO laws?
So think of RICO as an umbrella crime, where there's one overarching scheme. Here it is to overturn the election. And what is called racketeering activity that's done in furtherance of that, you know, common corrupt goal. And so, you know, you bring in different levels of players into this one sort of nefarious enterprise that's charged. And originally, RICO was enacted to prosecute mob bosses who would be able to evade prosecution because although they ran the operation, they didn't get their hands dirty by committing the actual crimes. And so here we see, you know, many layers of, you know, the sort of, you know, top players, Trump and those in his inner circle, you know, working their way down to people who were just brought in for, you know, particular aspects of, you know, these conspiracies. And, you know, in general, you know, there's a lot of similarities between, you know, federal RICO or other state RICO statutes. You know, as I said, both bring in various criminal acts into sort of the one overarching scheme. But Georgia has a slightly broader approach in that it doesn't require quite as much continuity of the enterprise as some other states. It has a broader array of criminal activity that qualifies as racketeering conduct. For instance, here, lying to government officials, also soliciting a crime, right? That's sufficient. And courts in Georgia have interpreted it, you know, liberally in terms of what evidence gets to come in. And that's usually the big advantage of RICO, is it allows a prosecutor to bring in evidence that they may not otherwise be able to get in. And in Georgia, for instance, they can actually bring in evidence that happened in other states. And you see that in the indictment, references to activity that happened in other states or in other counties like, you know, Coffee County. And so, you know, that's a big advantage. And this prosecutor particularly likes and has used RICO effectively in the past.
And reading the indictment, again and again, there are, you know, outlines of activity. This is under the RICO charges now, where an individual act might be legal. A tweet from the then President Trump or a call to a government official. those acts might not in and of themselves be illegal, but they're, it seems like, building a pattern of this wider goal, as you say, with the intent of overturning the election result. Can you talk about that, that kind of drumbeat of all these different activities that get painted through in the indictment?
Right. So some people might look at this and say, you know, why is it a crime to schedule a meeting, you know, in an official, you know, government building? That's not a crime, right? But that's one of the allegations that the, you know, for in order to facilitate the false electors, you know, being able to meet and, you know, indicate falsely that they were the true electors. So we see that, you know, there's much activity about tweeting, et cetera, but it's to give context, you know, for the entire scheme. And so when, you know, when jurors are listening, they're not just looking at something in a silo, right? They understand how the pieces of the puzzle fit together and have a greater context, which is very important for a prosecutor telling a narrative.
We're talking to Cheryl Bader from Fordham University's School of Law, looking at the latest charges brought against former President Donald Trump and 18 alleged co-conspirators by a grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia, earlier this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this latest indictment? Do you have questions about it, about how this will work in practice? Do you think this might have an impact on Trump's campaign for president? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Cheryl Bader from the Fordham University School of Law, looking at the fourth and most recent criminal indictment against former President Donald Trump relating to attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election outcome in the state of Georgia. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Join in with your reaction to this latest round of indictments against President Trump and 18 others. If you have questions for our guest about the various indictments against the former president, how they'll play out potentially in courts, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Aaron is with us in Oshkosh. Aaron, hi.
Yes, hello and good day, everybody. Thank you for taking the call. I was probably one of the last generations to actually go through a civics class in Madison, Wisconsin, back when they still did those things in high school. Now, it's been a while since I checked, and I believe that there are still requirements having to do with a person's character and not having criminal charges and these other restrictions that you had to do to, one, meet the bill to be able to run for either a public office, but especially the presidency, and with multiple felony charges against him in multiple districts across the country, both state, local, and federal, how is he even allowed to qualify to be able to run for the candidacy?
Aaron, thanks for the call. One important clarification, indictments and charges, but not convictions in any of these cases yet. And in constitutional law, Cheryl, you have to be a certain age. You have to meet citizenship requirements, and that's about it. So those kind of requirements aren't out there, as I understand it.
That's exactly right. One would think that we'd be learning in a civics class that you do have to have a certain character, but in fact, the Constitution doesn't speak to that. And so, you know, he could continue to hold office. There is sort of a little bit of an exception in the 14th Amendment that talks about when someone takes an oath to uphold the Constitution and they engage in insurrection, then they can't hold office. And so, you know, to the extent that in the, you know, DC case, to the extent that there's evidence around, you know, inciting the insurrection, could, even if he's not, you know, convicted of those charges, could a hearing be brought, you know, through Congress? Possibly. Also in the documents case, there would be issues if he is convicted about him having a security clearance in the future, And if, you know, because of the Espionage Act charges. And so, you know, that would certainly, you know, pose a problem, you know, for him if he's elected again. But, you know, again, we'll have to see how those things play out. But it's, you know, it's up to the people, and they have to sort of vote. And it amazes me that we're at a point where, again, he hasn't been convicted of anything. But I can't imagine a time when a candidate could have been indicted, you know, multiple times for these type of charges, and it wouldn't have been the death knell for the campaign. But here we see a very strong Donald Trump.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Cheryl, on a practical level, I understand the district attorney in Georgia wants to try all 19 defendants in one trial. I'm no lawyer. That sounds difficult, cumbersome, and time-consuming. What are you watching for on a practical level of bringing this through the courts?
Absolutely. It's very ambitious, and especially on the timetable that she seems to want to do this, right? You have, you know, 19 defendants. They're going to have lawyers. Some of them may have more than one lawyer. You have all these schedules to deal with. You also have, you know, multiple motions. They also have to all be prepared. And some of them may be representing, you know, Donald Trump in other cases. And so I think it may be quite unwieldy. We may have less defendants actually going to trial because people do plead guilty. You might see people also cooperating, some of the defendants cooperating the case, but it's been done, but it's quite a lift. And I don't think the time frame that she's laying out is I think it's overly optimistic.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hello.
Yeah, hi. Trump has a habit of throwing lawyers under the bus, and he's had trouble in the past of getting representation for that reason, either not paying them or betraying them. And I'm wondering whether that, and he's already making comments about how this grand scheme is really the idea of a bunch of lawyers. He wasn't involved. I'm wondering whether, A, does that hold among you know, in this kind of a prosecution, does that absolve him of guilt? And secondly, are they getting really hot testimony from some of the people that he's already indicated he's going to betray, I guess is the word.
Saul, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First of all, Cheryl, a possible defense Saul saying the president might make is, hey, my lawyers told me all this was fine, so I'm fine anyway. Maybe they're in trouble, but I'm not.
Right. So that may be his defense. I relied on the advice of my lawyer. But you know, that's fraught with certain problems. First of all, you know, you can't cherry pick and, you know, go through lawyer after lawyer. And remember, you know, the Justice Department, the intelligence community, right? Everyone is telling him, you know, that this is, you know, a fantasy, that there has been no, you know, fraud that would actually change the course of the election. And, you know, for him to go through and find that one outlier that's going to tell him, okay, we might, you know, find a way that this could work, I don't think is going to be a very viable defense. And also, as you said, like they're also going to be all sitting in the courtroom. And so, you know, sort of having the finger pointing both ways, you know, well, he's the one that told me to do it. Well, he's the one that did it, right? Is I think something that the prosecutor will be happy to have that sort of crossfire back and forth.
Thanks a lot for that call. Saul at 800-642-1234. Cheryl, as this is going on, leading up to these indictments coming out, the former president had encouraged a public official in Georgia, to not testify to the grand jury. He's been critical of judges, district attorneys, and prosecutors in various cases. Could former President Trump be opening himself up to new charges, witness tampering, contempt of court, and others?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen, you know, his very destructive rhetoric. And that's, I think, the reason why there has to be so much security, right? Trump has become the master of, you know, parsing his words so that, you know, his various supporters and minions sort of know what he's saying. And he there's been some really incendiary rhetoric around, you know, defaming, you know, prosecutors, judges, witnesses, law enforcement. And it's been very disturbing.
Now, looking at the various indictments working their way through the system now, Cheryl, I've seen some people make the case that, oh, these Georgia ones, these are the big deal. Others say, no, it's the Jack Smith January 6th ones. Which one do you watch more closely in the months to come? Which do you see as more significant, if either?
That's such a tough question because, you know, it's sort of like comparing is arson worse than murder? It's hard to compare the cases because there's so many, various factors. So as I said, in the documents case, I actually think that is the strongest case on the facts because they have, the smoking gun with, Trump showing these classified, very sensitive classified documents to people saying, oh, I know I could have declassified these previously, but I didn't. Telling, someone that they couldn't get close to a map because it was classified and sensitive, instructing his lawyer to say that we don't have any more documents and to sort of lose the ones that you found, surveillance tapes, et cetera. So, but it's complicated by the fact that, other people, including, sort of Biden, Pence, have, also had, documents in their possession. Of course, it's a very different situation because they turned them over very readily. They opened, their space and said, here, take whatever you have. It was a mistake. Whereas Trump really tried to hide these documents. But, I think that could be a potentially strong case, although, that's also going to be to probably the most conservative jury pool of the four cases. And so, the case in D.C., which is a lot like the case in Georgia that we're seeing now, I think that has, the potential to go before the election.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Cheryl Bader, clinical associate professor of law at Fordham University School of Law. We've been talking about the latest Trump indictment news, this one out of Georgia, and what we can expect to see as that case moves toward trial.